What's up, gang? It is Wednesday, June 25th, 2014. My name is Luke Thomas. This is the weekly live chat I do here on MMAfighting.com, part of SB Nation, which is, of course, part of Vox Media. Thank you for joining me this wonderful afternoon here, for me anyway, in Washington, D.C. Can you see behind me? You can see the offices there. Back to the broom closet, y'all, on the up and up. Today on the chat, we'll talk about the two fight nights this weekend, the Tahuna Marquardt card in New Zealand, the Cub Swanson, Jeremy Stevens card in San Antonio. If you'd like, we can also recap what happened last weekend in Los Angeles at the Forum, that being the two shows, Glory 17 and then Glory Last Man Standing. Two different shows, by the way. I mean, they were all sort of seamless there if you were there that night, but they're actually two different shows. And then, of course, anything else that you have on your mind in the world of combat sports, or sports really, or maybe even anything else. Whatever you want to ask, I will do my best to answer. Here on this lovely chat that we do. We go for about an hour and a half. If you're watching this on YouTube, the best place to put your questions in are going to be on MMAfighting.com, where there's a post dedicated to this, and then the comment section is where all the questions are. The ones that turn green get priority. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you may do so, at SBN Luke Thomas. I think I have a tool set now, right? Cameraman, control room. Well, maybe not. I thought I did. Well, whatever. In any event, so I'm trying to think. You can get me on Twitter. You can email me at luke.thomas@sbnation.com. And last, if you do me a favor, I don't have a can of Coke today that I normally open. You all know I love diet soda to an unhealthy degree, but nevertheless, I do love it. So if you would be so kind as to let folks know you're watching on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, whatever else is your social media medium of choice, please do that. And then, of course, you can link up this video. You can link up the post on MixedMartialArtsFighting.com. You can do any number of things. Just let folks know. Together, our collective might will help bring this chat to new and exciting levels. Yes? Yes. Okay. Let's go ahead and get right into it if we can. I'm looking at something here. Already a good amount of comments. I want to make sure it looks good on the site. My boss is out of town, so I'm like running the site by myself, which you have no idea. It doesn't look like much work, but it actually is a ton of work. So, gotta make sure it looks good. Okay. First question, Luke, what are your thoughts on Hendo's return to middleweight, and who, if anybody, would you like to see him fight first at that weight? I'm at the stage with Hendo where I am not particularly leaning one direction or the other about an opponent I'd like to see him face. I mean, typically when I have that inclination, it's because I'm looking for them to prove something. It's I'm looking to see if the matchup makes sense for rankings, if there's a particular style clash, if it would just create sort of interesting action. With Henderson, he's on that Rich Franklin path, where he's sort of bracketing weight classes, right? Going to 185, jumping to 205, going back to 185, jumping to 205, going back to 185. Now, Franklin didn't do it quite to that extent, but you get the idea where your ability to compete at the very highest level has already been compromised. But you're still a popular attraction. You're still a very good fighter. So you're trying to find an open space in a weight class where you can still get the biggest fights possible for you. And, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. The longer you're away from middleweight, typically the more it makes interesting the fact that you're returning. And that goes for any weight class, welterweight, whatever. As long as you competed in a weight class and then left it, and then you come back, sort of reinvigorates your value as an addition to the roster. But if there's any sort of one particular thing I'm looking for, the answer is not much, you know. I would hate to see him misused in a way where he was, you know, fed to somebody who was also on the outs or had limited upside or something like that. Like, if you're going to feed off what's left of his name, because that's how the game works, right? You almost everybody, except maybe George St. Pierre, they go out getting ravaged by the young of their division. This is a sport that eats its elderly. You know, it's fine to do that if you're going to feed to somebody with some promise in the division or who you really need to sell. But short of that, I don't really care. Not to say I don't care about Baron Henderson fighting. I mean, I don't have any like one opponent in mind where, God, I really need to see that fight. I mean, there's a bunch of good ones out there, I'm sure. I would just like to see what's left of his career be used in a way that certainly benefits Dan to the extent possible, but being realistic also helps buoy some sort of rising middleweight or somebody that could really benefit from a win that you could then use as a way to sell, because that's sort of how this business works, whether you like it or not. But, you know, that's sort of the signal that you're looking for there. Once you see somebody go back and forth that many times between a weight class, particularly the advanced age that he is, you know, they're in a position where, you know, they're on their last legs a little bit as a career, which is fine. I mean, Dan Henderson already has a Hall of Fame career. He could retire tomorrow and it'd be okay. Someone wrote a really long comment about eye pokes. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm not going to read any of it out loud anyway. But you should check it out. It's written by Loftist. I think that's what it says. And it's the basic argument is that everyone's saying, well, look at this clamoring to make sure we get a new design on gloves, because everyone is saying, look at the Pride era. There were very few eye pokes during that time. But his point is that if you looked at the UFC at that time, there were also fewer eye pokes. So it may not be necessarily glove technology in as much as the style of fighting, that the current way in which guys fight, John Jones in particular and so, sort of many others with their hands open like that, that's contributing to eye poking. It's an evolution of technique in an unfortunate direction, not that we regress technologically from a worse glove. Let me start with a different one first. Eddie Bravo at Metamoris, in a recent Joe Rogan Experience podcast, Eddie Bravo discussed the uneven rules that Eddie was forced to agree to at Metamoris, how they forced Eddie to wear the gi pants. Well, that's not quite true. What the reality was that he initially wanted to, then didn't want to, but by the time he had agreed to it, they didn't want to change it up. In the end, they were rules that favored both guys a lot, right? I mean, Eddie had a full long-sleeve rash guard, which I never wear. That's not true. I wear, like, very occasionally, because it's so hot. All the fingers taped and ankle supports and gi pants. I mean, that's about as non-no-gi as you're going to get, right? It's no-gi, but it's just, I mean, all you're missing is a belt, right? I mean, you're missing the kimono up top, too. But in any event, once he had committed to it, they went back and said, well, you know, you can't change it now. It didn't matter in the end because Eddie's just a better grappler than Hoyler is at this point. And all that's fine, but I don't think there's any big conspiracy there about that. I will say, though, that like, I think that, and I've been doing a lot of thinking about it, and I'm open to more information, believe me. I'm not done thinking about it. I'm just saying, in the current process of where I am, trying to mull it over, I think Eddie's no-gi techniques for no-gi are probably pretty good. Not for every body type, but there's probably a wide range of body types that's really good for. But I don't think they're good at all for MMA. I could be wrong. I'd love to be proven wrong. But I just think a focus on the guard for anything but sweeps and quick submissions, and if you can't get him back to sweeps or creating distance, it's just not going to work in modern MMA. Pay-per-view buy rates. Just as you have anecdotal evidence of the difficulty in gathering casual fans to watch UFC events these days, and this person says I do as well, and second-year assertions of oversaturation, with their general complacency to the current MMA climate, I find it more and more common for even the hardcore fans to bootleg the fights, either through a live stream or watching the video the following morning. Do you think the ease with which one can bootleg a fight these days has any effect on current pay-per-view buy rates? It seems that literally everyone I know weighs the option of paying or streaming, whereas 5 or more years ago it seemed much more difficult to attain an uninterrupted stream or non-deleted video, and thus more enticing to pay for a subpar event. No doubt about it. I mean, you can make all the claims you want about oversaturation, and I think they're all real. The truth is they're also in a battle against technology. Do you guys see those? I mean, it's a different situation. But today, the Supreme Court, Aereo, lost their case. Now, that's a completely different situation about what was going on, but I just mean there's the ability to cheaply get illegal content, which is now how basically that's being labeled in a way. But follow me here. Content's getting more expensive. The technology to grab content is getting cheaper and easier. And it's being more widely disseminated. It's very, very easy to get this kind of thing, even relative to 5 years ago. And I thought it was easy 5 years ago. I didn't think it was very hard at all to get a live stream illegally in 2009. It's a joke today. So sure, you can make all the comments you want about oversaturation. You can bash UFC and then previously Bellator doing 26 shows a year. You can say all those things. But the truth is they're also in a battle with that kind of dynamic. It is extremely easy, very easy, to get illegally streamed content. Boxing, mixed martial arts, anything. Anything. It's very, very easy. And I have no doubt that it substantively affects buy rates. Now, you know, by half? No. By a quarter? Probably not even that. But that's still, even if it's 10, 15%, that's still a significant amount of money. Especially when you sort of think about it aggregately. Like if you lost 10, I mean, imagine if you owned a store, right? You owned a store, you owned a Gap, okay? And imagine if you lost 10 to 15% of your merchandise through shoplifting. You'd be losing an S-load of money. It's a lot of money. You still might make more money, and you still might be able to pay all your employees on time and pay rent to the commercial real estate developer and everything else, but still, if you lose 10% of your merchandise, I mean, it's not, the analogy is not quite, it's not a one-to-one analogy, but I'm just trying to think about, like, how much inventory UFC loses to the sort of ease of technology. I think they exacerbate their problem through oversaturation. Don't get me wrong, but I do think that people have been trained to pay for things online that they like just as much as there's an inclination among people to steal. I used to get all my songs. I was in college when Napster came out. There was years I went, even after through all the Lars Ulrich versus Napster thing, where I used to get all my MP3s illegally. I don't do that at all anymore. I pay Spotify, or occasionally, but almost never, but occasionally, let's say iTunes. I pay for Netflix. I pay for, you know, and even pay-per-view items. Like, for example, I know someone says illegal stream technology sucks. It's not as good. It's not. First of all, I know all the high places you can get high-definition streams. First of all, they exist. And second of all, even places that don't do the high-definition streams, this is readily available. All you have to do is get on Google or ask around. You can easily disseminate it. But there are high-definition streams. I've seen them. In any event. But like, so for example, and I won't go into jiu-jitsu too much here, I'll just sort of quickly state, Budo Videos is a place that sells gis and videos and instructionals for jiu-jitsu. They used to stream the IBJJF Worlds and Pan Ams and stuff. And now the IBJJF just basically contracted them out. So it's through IBJJFTV.com. Same technology, really, and it's the same commentators and everything. But what you get is you get all the white belts, all the blue belts, all the purple belts, all the brown belts, all the black belts, every match if you want. And they have sort of three camera angles. They have one overhead camera angle of all 10 mats. Then you can pick the commentary once. You can get the guys doing commentary, and they'll switch from the mats based on what's most important, what's going on. Or you can just pick whatever mat you want at random. You can, I want mat 2, I want mat 3, I want mat 5. You can open up several camera angles all at once, and that's cost about $45. You get $45, you get the entire experience. Dude, I'll pay for that. I'll pay for that. I wouldn't have to. I'm sure there's a million ways to illegally stream that, but I feel like that's a reasonable ask of me. This is a transaction I'm willing to make. So I do think that the oversaturation exacerbates the nature to which they suffer from technological theft. But technological theft would exist irrespective of that anyway. Joe Rogan podcast. Would you ever consider doing the Joe Rogan Experience podcast? You got a shout out by your colleague Duke Rufus. During his time on the JRE, I'd love to hear you shoot the S with Joe Rogan on combat sports. Maybe get the Donk Army to rally to get you on the JRE. I would love to, but I don't think I'm... he has famous people on there. I'm not a famous person by a million miles. Believe me, I go to the grocery store. TMZ is not asking me about my opinion, let me assure you. I'm lucky I get to go on TV every other month or something like that for a little bit, but... That's a show. I mean, listen, I'm not saying I wouldn't. I would love to, but I, just speaking realistically, that's for famous people. Luke, other than scaling back the tournament format, what changes would you like to see Scott Coker implement in Bellator moving forward? Tournament is one, although I would not like to see them get rid of it altogether. I do think it has value once in a while. Once in a while, it could be really fun, actually. So that's one. Two, I'd like to see one event a month, two at the most. I'd like to see a lot of that roster cut. I'd like to see them go beyond casinos. I don't think they should move away from casinos completely. The Hard Rock Hotel and Casino, they can go to be good. The Hollywood Seminole. Certainly Mohegan Sun, where they're going to start out. Those are fine. Rebel, that kind of thing is fine. I guess substantively, though, I think they should bring back women. By the way, I have some indication that they will do that. I have very, very strong word that Bellator is going to bring back women. How soon? I don't know. Could be a year. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do about that. But I definitely I would count on that happening. I would like to see some of. I mean, they can't do all this right away. I don't think there's going to be any kind of name change. I mean, they might do that. I doubt it. I would like to see them change some of the imaging. When you get on Spike TV, I often find it a bit too dark. A lot of black, a lot of brown, a lot of dark red. I would like to see it livened up a little bit, you know? I mean, the Pride broadcasts, and everyone's like, oh, this is just romanticism. But, like, who didn't like the fact that it seems so bright at the time? And it sounds like a small thing, but, like, I don't know. I kind of believe that you're setting a certain tone, both from a color palette and, I mean, a sort of a metaphorical tone to your broadcast when it's really dark or when it's really light. Now, some reasons they have to keep it dark is because they don't have any people in attendance. They have to sort of darken the crowd. All right, I get it. But I'm just saying, if that was something they would like to do, I would like to see. I think that's more than a cosmetic change, to be honest. I think working in partnership with Spike TV will be really interesting for them because I think it'll work for Bellator, despite Bellator being themselves. Remember, Spike and Bellator, those shows that they were created, it wasn't like... I mean, they had to work in partnership with each other. Like, both sides had to approve of it, and it was sides. It wasn't sort of one unanimous force. But beyond that, I don't know. Let's keep an open mind. I think Scott Coker has his style of matchmaking is effective. I think we can see from the absorption of Strikeforce that the roster that they had built was tremendous, that those guys were certainly on par with the UFC's best, by and large. I'd like to see them bring back... I'd like to see them sign Ben Askren. I'm told that, you know, ONE FC is taking really good care of Ben Askren. He's got a family. He's got another business, the AWA Wrestling Camp. So maybe he doesn't need it, but I'm just saying personally, I'd like to see Ben Askren get a shot at some better welterweights. They need to sign better welterweights. But I don't know. From there, I need to see things that are creative. Scott Coker's a creative force, you know, and to the extent that he can let that breathe, and I'm sure he has the license to do that, I'd be really excited. So for now, nothing. Let's see. Let's see them bring back women. Let's see them cut a lot of these guys just being just terrible fighters in the roster. Let's just call it what it is. Let's see them cut a lot of the dead weight. Let's see them have fewer shows. Let's see them have important build-up and conference calls and open workouts and press conferences. And not just holding them, but holding them in places and in environments and in events where people are interested in going. That they want to show up to the Bellator press conference. They want to go to the open workouts. They want to... interview these fighters and talk to these guys. That's what you need. That's what you need. So we'll see. You know, someone asks, is there going to be more shoulder programming? I don't know. The shoulder programming is expensive. I'm sure that if they do fewer shows, that they'll have more access to that, or probably at least more sharply used in that way. But we'll see. Also, I wouldn't mind seeing Bellator move to Sundays. Now, in the football season, that's going to be tough. But so they have to roll on Fridays for the current time, that's fine because they won't compete with any but high school football or low-level college football on that level. But when the time comes, if they can move to Sundays, I think that would be awesome. I think that would be really, really good for them. MMA from the casual point of view. I was listening to a couple of guys talking at a bar over the weekend, and they seemed to be casual MMA fans who didn't know the difference between promotions. To them, everything was UFC. They referred to Kingmo and Rampage as UFC fighters. Also, they blatantly said they used to be into it, but that dude bro fad died out a long time ago. you think this is indicative of how casuals view MMA? Will this always be a niche sport? I think so. Yeah, you know, like in this whole soccer debate, everyone's talking about, well, guys, soccer's been around for 100 years, Luke. You should calm down. Give MMA time. MMA can be around for 1,000 more years. It's never going to beat soccer. You need to just accept it. It's never going to be a couple on the ass of soccer. And that's okay, you know. I mean, worldwide, the NFL isn't. Now, the NFL is the biggest league of all those things, right? NFL is bigger than Premier League. NFL is bigger than UEFA or whatever. But American football worldwide, people don't care about American football. It's never going to be anything worldwide. They might break into London, and they might break into Toronto. Yay! That they're just good. It's our sport, and that's fine. It doesn't have to be anything but our sport. Canada can have some too, right? That's just the reality. That's just the reality. And it's fine. Like, MMA is awesome as it is. It doesn't need to be the most amazing number one sport that people just can't get enough of worldwide. I think, you know, what the reality, the truth of it is that we often talk about, you know, MMA being more mobile than other sports. You can take it to India, you can take it to Germany, you can take it to South Africa and so forth. And I definitely agree with a lot of that. I definitely think fist fighting, professional fist fighting, I certainly agree that that is more mobile than cricket, than more mobile than American football, which is a distinct, I mean, it's a distinctly American thing, right? I mean, football is like Guy Fieri or something like that. Right, I mean, that's just only America can produce that kind of thing. I mean, it's better than that, but you get the idea. It's like apple pie. But I still think, I mean, I wonder if we have cultural blinders on to our own proclivities and our own eccentricities and our own ways of doing things. In other words, UFC is an American company. Now, it may soon become a global brand, but it started out as an American company. And it has international roots. There's no denying it. There's no denying it. There will always be an international feel to mixed martial arts for many number of reasons. But I mean the UFC's product, right? As good as it is, it's the premier product. There's nothing better than UFC in this space. But it still has, you know, probably an American feel to it. And it still has probably American associations with it. You know, it's not easy for foreign brands to break into America. It's happened quite successfully in other sort of consumer spaces, right? We get a lot of our cars from Japan, right? But I mean, I just mean that we need to sort of take note of the fact that as global and as mobile as mixed martial arts is, in the current way in which it's being spread as I think there are some underpinnings of American identity. Where they begin and the end is kind of hard to sort of decipher sometimes. But I bet if you asked people from China, I bet if you asked people from Germany or even the UK, they would tell you that there's a bit of an American feel to things. It's hard to tailor things culturally. And you know, the UFC is struggling with that. And I don't mean like they're drowning. I mean it's a challenge that they face every day. Right? How do you tailor a product for a local market that has certain cultural eccentricities and yet have a sort of a standard of excellence, a standard of production, a sort of way in which you do things. And they're having to adapt that. But they wouldn't have to adapt that if it was just sort of like uniformly mobile. They're having to adapt to it from its American position. So I think that sort of thing has to be taken into account. Now, as for your point, this is something that actually benefits UFC. I saw someone make this point. I can't remember who it was. But they were saying, imagine if you never saw MMA. Imagine, right? Then you finally saw, let's say, Kingmo versus Rampage, and you saw the advertising on Spike, and you maybe you bought the pay-per-view, and you just weren't really paying attention to some of the naming conventions, or forget all that. You were at a friend's house and they were watching it, right? You would call it UFC, wouldn't you? Right? Because the UFC brand is so dynamic. This is one reason why they put so much emphasis behind their brand, is so that they can have everything siphons to UFC. In other words, if Bellator creates an MMA fan, that Bellator fan is inevitably going to end up as a UFC fan because that's the premium product, and fans are going to gravitate in that direction. Now, they may not choose Bellator over it, or they might. They could do that too, but point being is even if a fan becomes a Strikeforce fan or a Pride fan or a Bellator fan, inevitably the vast majority of them are going to eventually become UFC fans because that's the existing premier product. So that's one of these challenges that these guys face, man. They're going to have a real hard time establishing a fan base when what they're really doing is serving as a siphoning to the UFC. Luke, how do you see Chael Sonnen's chances against Andre Galvan? The next Metamorphs card, can Chael hang with Galvan on the ground, or is he bitten off more than he could chew? First of all, I wouldn't say it's crazy that Galvan could get a takedown. I don't think he will. I don't think he'll try for it, but, and especially because they're not in the gi. But if they were in the gi, for sure to get the takedown. You laugh, Demi and Maia got through Chael Sonnen. So it's not crazy, but he'll probably end up on bottom, and that's fine. You know, he's going to get swept with a quickness. It's not going to – I mean, if Galvan wants it to go long, or if Chael uses really strong anti-jiu-jitsu, it might last long. Galvan is going to have his way with him, you know. And if it was a points-based match, it'd be a – I mean, jiu-jitsu doesn't have it, but it'd be a tech fall for sure. For sure. He's going to get caught. I mean, Chael's really, really good, and he's a great wrestler. But these guys who are these black belts at this level, man, like, it's not – you know, they're not doing magic tricks. They just have so many tools in their arsenal. So many ways to off-balance you. So many ways to get you to commit certain ways that you don't want to or don't even recognize or dangerous. If they're way, way too good, man. They're way too good. Somebody like that is just like, you know, talking about all, top five all time. Let's see. Lack of promotion for UFC 175. Really? I think there's actually been a fair amount. Luke, is it just me, or has there been a complete lack of promotion for UFC 175? The fight is taking place next week, and I haven't seen any commercials or ads for it, nor do I see a ton of buzz for the show. Or is the UFC too busy trying to sell us on UFC Auckland, Tahuna versus Marquardt, arguably the worst main event in UFC history? Well, it's definitely the worst main event in the modern era. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. But I disagree with you a little bit. I actually think there's been a fair amount of, I don't know if there's been a lot of buzz yet for 175, but I have seen the ads rolling around. Chris Weidman has begun to do the media tours. This is going to be one of those shows that gets buzz that really builds at the beginning of next week and continues to go. But I think that show is going to do a decent buy rate, 400,000 or 500,000 maybe. Certainly more than 3. If it does less than 4, that's a little scary. But I think it'll do more than that. I think it'll be a show that does a good pay-per-view buy rate, and it's going to build. It's going to start on Monday or Tuesday. By Wednesday, you're really going to be feeling it, and then Thursday on. When Rousey gets to go in and everything else, I think it'll be fine. I mean, it's, you know, you're hampered by the fact you lost Sonnen versus Vitor or Sonnen versus Vanderlei. But nevertheless, I disagree a little bit. I think that you don't feel it this week, but you probably will next week. Someone says, my mind is blown at the idea of Tahuna and Marquardt are worthy to headline. Yeah. We'll get to that a little bit later. Someone asked like 10 questions in one thing, so I'll try to do these really fast. Number one, do some members of the press know who is in the final of the Ultimate Fighter before the tough finale show? Historically, yes. I don't know about this season. What specifically does Dana White mean when he says the politics is difficult to get into countries like China, Russia, and Germany? Well, it's different in each of them. There could be certain, for example, in Holland, they have a law that was established when there was a link connected, there's a documentary about it, between organized crime and kickboxing. So they established a law that if someone is staging an event at any point and the law suspects that there is reason to believe that elements of organized crime are involved or will be there, they can shut it down before it happens, which is why the UFC is probably hesitant to put up a show in the Netherlands. And that's a bit of a big problem. But, you know, the issue for UFC is getting the right kind of television deal in China, getting kind of any kind of government sanctioning in different places that they may need to go to, certain laws to navigate in Germany. There's institutional powers that run boxing in Germany that have made UFC's entrance there hard. I had someone debating on me on Reddit, being like, Germany is only 1/6 of Europe's population. You stupid bastard. Europe is Germany's largest economy. Of course it's a prime target for the UFC. Of course it is. And they love boxing there. I mean, it's like, how can we even debate this? 3, have you heard anything about Metamoris coming to Fight Pass, only as much as you guys have. And I am, if it happens, I am 100% in favor of it. Would one Fox card and one pay-per-view a month still be too much UFC for you? If that's all that it was, probably not. Lots of South Koreans on the UFC roster. Any thoughts on why the UFC have not gone there yet? Spoke to Marshall Zelaznik about this. They are going to go. One of the reasons why they couldn't go there is, despite some of the venues being nice and you know consumer-friendly, they're not really good for the technology they need to stream. And what happened is, as the UFC pushed into Brazil, they were able to develop some of the sort of workarounds to make that work, which they can now take and go to places like South Korea. So I'm told that should be on the docket for certainly 2015, if not 2014. Why had the UFC never gone to Hawaii? Wouldn't BJ Penn basically sell out the Aloha Stadium? Historically, there used to be a tax that would prevent them from putting on certainly a pay-per-view. Also, the time difference would be bad. But now with Fight Pass, they might end up doing it. From what you know, do UFC fighters who appear as analysts on Fox get media training? Some do, yes. Sometimes when fighters read off the teleprompter, it sounds like a child reading for the first time. TV is so much harder than you think it is. It is so much harder than you think it is. I do a lot of jobs. I've been in radio since 2008. I work for MMAfighting.com. I built, with the help of and certainly the partial leadership together as a partnership with Nate Wilcox, I built Bloody Elbow out of scratch. I feel like I've done a fair amount in mixed martial arts. That glory gig I do is the hardest one of them all, man. It is so much more difficult than you think it is. And guys who have natural abilities like Brian Stan are treasures. They are once-in-a-lifetime kind of guys, man. When you can say what you want about Ryan Seacrest, and you can say what you want about Carson Daly. Maybe they are D-bags, I don't know. But let me tell you, their broadcasting technique is there. It's Messi and Ronaldo. Do you think Dana secretly likes having inept judging, as if the system was less susceptible to human fallibility, fighters would play more for points? No. I think he thinks it's a giant headache. If you had to guess, what do you think the revenue split is between Zuffa and its fighters? Somewhere between 20 and 30%. I just went back and watched the first ever MMA beat. Arlo asked you to give a UFC a grade. That was interesting. I just went back and watched the first ever MMA beat. Arlo asked you to give the UFC a grade after Dana's comment that the next 2 years will be the most important for the company. There was a consensus that it was sort of too early to tell. 2 years have roughly passed now. What grade does the UFC get? Grade for what? I have to go back and watch. I don't know. I think on some things they've done really well, and other things it's getting to some scary territory. If y'all see that 174 is doing 100,000 buys or less, which they haven't done since 2005, and that doesn't put the hair on the back of your neck up, you got some serious questions you got to start asking yourself. Someone says, are squash matches, like Tahuna Marquardt, I wouldn't call that a squash match. I mean, I'd favor Tahuna, I guess, right? What are the odds on that? Let's see. Who the odds makers have is the odds on favor. Yeah, like I said, I'd favor Tahuna in that fight, but I don't know, man. I wouldn't count on Marquardt just yet. But somebody asks, are those the future of Fight Night cards? I don't know the future of Fight Night cards exactly, but I would say that's one benefit of oversaturation. Like, we always have these discussions about oversaturation as if it's some sort of zero-sum game. It's actually really complicated. There's a lot of moving parts about this, and everyone says, is it a win? Is it a bad thing? You can't even talk about it in those terms. What does it mean to say it's a win? There's so many disparate, non-overlapping elements to oversaturation. You need to be very specific about what you're talking about. Now, if you wanted to add all those up and then say, was this a net win for the sport, I'd be okay with having that kind of discussion, but only with a caveat at the outset that you're talking about all, you acknowledge just how varying it is. I think there are some benefits to oversaturation, if I'm being honest. These are things that wouldn't have to happen, like they could happen without oversaturation. I don't think the oversaturation is required to make them happen, but it's facilitating it. So, for example, you get a fight like Corasani versus Poirier. That's a squash match. You know, Corasani had his moment in the sun there in the first round. But a fighter like Dustin Poirier is going to be able to wade through that and get through. That was a guy. That was a guaranteed blowout. People think blowouts are just somebody coming in there like, you know, Cody McKenzie versus Chad Mendes. I mean, that's not even a blowout. That's just that I can't even believe the commission sanctioned that. But a you know, Poirier versus Corsani, it's good for guys who are like Poirier. They get money. They can win bonuses. They stay active and they get tune-up fights. Tune-up fights were something that people just really lacked in the UFC for the longest time. I remember the first time I really thought somebody getting a tune-up fight was when Rampage on a main event had to fight Matt Hamill last minute, and then went into the John Jones fight after that, I believe. Like the Hamill fight served as a decent setup. He got paid, he went in there and got to use some of his skills. In the end, it didn't really help him so much to get past John Jones, but, you know, it's John Jones. Losing to him is no big deal. So there are some benefits to oversaturation. There's no doubt about it, you know. Do I think the UFC is doing too many shows? Sure. Do I think that this is having a damaging effect on some aspects of their business? Absolutely. Do I think they're going to facilitate growth in Latin America via their push there? I do. I do think that. That still doesn't solve a lot of other problems. But Latin America, without the UFC's help, is at least 10 years away from being and producing the kind of mixed martial arts climate via attendance at shows and producing world-class talent. It's 10 years away, minimum. UFC might be able to fast-track that, man. They might be able to fast-track that. That's a real benefit. There's no denying it. There's no denying it. I mean, I guess unless it fails miserably, which I don't think it will, but you get the idea. Like, there's so many different ways oversaturation can be evaluated. It's just stupid to say, it's a win. No, it's bad. Well, what parts of it are winning and what parts of it are bad? People say the video link's not working. The video link should be working. Well, let me make sure the video link is working. I don't see an indication it's not working. Anyway, so whenever you talk about oversaturation going forward, last thing I'll say about it for now, be clear about what you're talking about. Talent development, licensing deals, pay-per-view revenues at home, popularity, North America. What are you discussing exactly? The common fallacy of why, quote-unquote, super athletes don't enter into MMA. Luke on Joe Rogan's podcast 2 weeks ago, he had Steve Maxwell on, and they got into a discussion about how the NFL had superior athletes to MMA, which is true, they do. Steve mentioned it was because of the money, and Joe blew it off, saying the pay scale of MMA would be close enough to get someone incredibly dominant. That's also true. Well, mostly true. Well, Rogan is obviously wrong about the pay scale. Isn't the real, because, I mean, yes, the very highest level fighter, I mean, GSP is going to make commensurate salaries to what guys in the NFL make, or more. But, you know, we're talking about one guy versus a league where the league min for being on the practice squad is 140. If you make the roster, it's like 4 or 5. The real reason why you won't ever see high-level athletes in combat sports is because education dictates what kids play growing up. If you're a 14-year-old kid going into high school, do you choose to compete on a football team where you will skyrocket in popularity at your school, date the prom queen, and get a scholarship to a top university where you can play in front of 100,000 fans, or do you choose to go on a wrestling team or some MMA gym where you are paying out the nose for training? That's going to be one major reason why you don't see that. But I would not say that's going to be a reason why most high-level athletes, particularly the heavyweight class, are going to do stick and ball sports, right? I mean, LeBron James is 6'7", 275. That's a horse, man. That is a horse. I mean, that's just a ridiculous level athlete. But, you know, or Ndamukong Suh or Justin Tuck or something like that, right? But that's certainly one aspect, is that scholastically that serves as our amateur system. But you'll always get guys, though, who will be athletes on par with them who simply are inclined ideologically different, right? I mean, Aaron Pico, I don't know if he's going to go into MMA, but he's in combat sports, and he's going to be there for a long time. The kid is an athlete beyond, like, description, you know what I mean? I'm sure his wrestling IQ is off the charts. I bet his athleticism is also, too, you know? It's just not all, what you're talking about are going to be limiting factors. They're not going to be exclusively limiting factors. Fighter association game. Name the first fighter you think of. Not active enough. Dominic Cruz fights too often, Donald Cerrone. I don't know if that's even true that he does. I'm just playing the game. Perfect guy for sponsors, John Jones. Seems to enjoy doing media, Frank Mir. Used to be Frank Mir. I don't know if it is anymore. Who's a guy who loves doing media? Loves is such a strong word. I don't think any of them love it. Diego Sanchez, maybe? Has the best group of managers and agents. Probably George St. Pierre. Maybe Gilbert Melendez. Will fight for a title in 2015, not including Cormier. Nurmagomedov. Hey, Luke, now that Anthony Pettis' face is on a Wheaties box, will you be eating more cereal more often? Nope. But happy for Anthony. What could UFC actually or theoretically pull in primetime TV? What does that mean? I was having a discussion with my friend about how MMA is still somewhat of a niche. It's not still somewhat of a niche sport. It is a niche sport. For example, the average NFL game pulls in 17 million viewers, and that's not even close to what they could do for a playoff game. The last Super Bowl did 115 million. Could UFC and their current popularity ever pull 17 million? Meaning, what do you think roughly UFC 168 would have gotten if it was on Fox? Oh, that is hard to say. That's hard to say. Wow, it's a great question. Nobody really knows, you know. I mean, this is the reality of the UFC and the way their pay structure works. It's a premium product. It's a premium product. It's a premium product that is sold behind a paywall. Now you got a taste of that with Velasquez versus Dos Santos Juan, which I think peaked close to 10 million, but only averaged about 6, which is still extremely high, obviously. It's really impossible to say. I think it could probably do close to 10 million, maybe, on the right card, you know? I mean, if you can get one fight to do 6, you know, part of that was just a curiosity factor, too. I don't know. Here's what I would say. If you really stack the card, when I say stack the card, I don't mean put on, like, contender fights. I mean with stars. Guys who move the needle, or ladies who move the needle, a Rousey, a Jones, a GSP, a Velasquez. But if you did that, right, put it on free TV, and I mean marketed the hell out of that thing. Cleverly, you know, talking about we're going to put on a free card, we want to prove, or whatever clever angle they can come up with. Do I think that could average 10 mil and reach 15 mil? Yeah, certainly do. I certainly think it could. You'd be cannibalizing your product in the process, but you're just asking theoretically how high could it go? Maybe even higher than that, you know. Flyweight division is not going to go away. Good question. Kevin Ioli on oversaturation. Luke, what are your thoughts on Kevin Ioli's article on oversaturation that he wrote earlier this week? I think I still have it up, as a matter of fact. Let me see here. It's called Why the UFC's Saturation Strategy Makes Perfect Sense. Again, when we talk about oversaturation, we have to talk about the disparate. There we go. The window is not up on. Are y'all having technology problems? Some of y'all are, it appears. Hang on. I don't know. Some of y'all might be. I don't know. Anyway. Yeah, here's my thoughts on that. Again, it depends what you want to talk about. There are some. First, let me mention something about Kevin Ioli because I don't think he gets enough praise, to be honest. Kevin Ioli is the most successful journalist. I mean, he's a big deal in boxing. He's a big deal in MMA, right? Like, he's a winner. Even if you cut out half of his career, he's a winner no matter how you slice it, you know? But Kevin Ioli is the most successful guy to cover boxing and MMA at a high level. There's nobody who does it better, legitimately. There's nobody who does it better. I mean, you may have some issues with the way he covers boxing. Everyone has issues with the way everyone covers everything. Or you may not like something he wrote about mixed martial arts. Let me tell you something. At the highest level, which is what he does, no one covers both boxing and MMA together better than Kevin Ioli. He is the guy for that. I've tried my hand at boxing coverage. It's hard, man. It's really hard. And when he came from boxing over to mixed martial arts, because that's where he started his career, not to say he wasn't a fan or was watching before that, but I'm just saying, like, when he sort of made a decision to start covering that stuff, you know, it wasn't easy for him either, you know. And he made it work. And it's impressive what he's done, man. He's the only guy who can talk about both at a consistently high level with the deep intricacies and knowledge about both, how both industries work. Only him. Only Kevin Ireland. I have dabbled in boxing, and it's very difficult to do well, and he does it well. So I want to first sort of, like, say, like, what is Kevin Ireland's contribution to mixed martial arts and boxing? Many things. But one thing that sort of stands out to me is that. And I like Kevin a lot. I have a profound amount of respect for him. You know, I see him at all the shows. When he talks, you should listen. Doesn't mean you have to agree with everything, but you should listen. So, I mean, there's some things where I think he's right, you know. I think some things he says that makes some good points. But ultimately, it's not an article I can agree with in large part. I hope he's right. You know, I'd love to be wrong. But he makes a number of points, some of which I agree with more than others, some of which I don't agree with at all. But the basic idea is he makes a point substantively, like the number of shows, that there's a theory that UFC brass have, which is that we don't need a bunch of hardcore fans. I mean, it's good to have them, and we'll do what we can for them, but we don't need to add a whole bunch more. What we need is to add casual fans, right? And he sort of points out correctly that what's the difference between a pay-per-view event that sells 150,000 buys versus 500,000? The answer is casual fans. Hardcore fans don't like the idea that they don't hold the keys to the universe, but they don't. You don't. The keys to the universe are held, in terms of a monetary perspective, by the wider purchasing audience. And that is casual fans. It's a fact. Kevin Ollie is 100% right about that. I think he and I have talked about that at length before. But the theory, though, is that if we can get more casual fans, we can make more money. I agree. But the theory underlining that, or I should say underpinning that, is that if what we need to do to get more casual fans is run more shows, certainly on free broadcast television and then globally. Now, globally doesn't so much matter for pay-per-view, right? That's the first problem with the argument. Getting fans in China does nothing for UFC pay-per-view buy rates. Zero. It doesn't matter at all. Germany, Europe, none of this matters. It's just a North American phenomenon to a lesser extent, Australia. Maybe New Zealand. I don't even know about that. But you get the idea. It's really, basically, it's a North American phenomenon. Right? Let me find a relevant passage here. Because it's an important article. Let's see. This is Kevin talking. 4 or 5 years ago, when the UFC was putting on far fewer shows, that likely would have happened. But because of the exceptional number of shows, Swanson versus Stevens is going to headline a Fox Sports 1 card from San Antonio, while Penn Edgar 3 will headline the tough finale card in Las Vegas on July 6th, the day after UFC 175. The success of a pay-per-view show is rarely due to hardcore fans. That's where he's right. Promoters in both boxing and mixed martial arts can count upon a reliably consistent number of serious fans to purchase every pay-per-view show. But the difference in one show selling 150 and another doing 500,000 is the amount of casual fans that's able to reel in. Correct. White and UFC CEO Lorenzo Fertitta are not stupid. They know they'd sell significantly more pay-per-views if the main card were Weidman Machida and Rousey versus Davis, Penn versus Edgar, Swanson versus Stevens, and Tahuna versus Marquardt. But they're doing the right thing and making a long-term play. They lose nothing if they ultimately determine that the market can't bear so many shows. They simply can cut the fat, so to speak, and have fewer shows, in the process adding more star power to the pay-per-view offerings. If they're right, though, and that people need to become fans, if they're right, though, and all that people need to become fans is exposure to the sport on a regular basis, then this is the way to go. That would then theoretically also lead to development of more and better fighters. Wider interest among fans would mirror wider interest among athletes, and more quality young athletes turning to MMA now will lead to future stars 5, 10, 15 years down the road. That's really the gist of the argument. I mean, he makes more than that, and let's be fair. But that's really the issue here. Does wider exposure to the sport create more casual fans? Here's the argument that I would say about that. Is there any indication we're creating more casual fans and therefore adding to the pay-per-view subscriber base, either on a casual or hardcore basis. There is zero evidence that is happening. In fact, it's going in the opposite direction. Okay? It is true that when the UFC enters new markets, there is, at least in some respects, certainly in Latin America, Mexico, for example, I mean, we'll see how South America pans out, but let's sort of point to Mexico, your point to the UK, so it's initial stages. Just like when the UFC goes to Baltimore for the first time, or San Antonio for the first time, there's a pretty enthusiastic response. The question about the UFC is not their ability to create interest. The question is the ability to sustain it. And they're two different skills. They're two different challenges. They're two different, completely, responsibilities. The UFC is excellent at creating interest, initially. It is much harder to sustain it. Much, much, much harder to sustain it. I'm not saying they've done a poor job of that. I'm simply saying that's a completely different challenge. Getting people to turn once to watch something, they got that down. Down. And I think they'll eventually figure out some of these larger markets too. Don't get me wrong. I think China's going to be a tough nut to crack, but I suspect we'll have a measure of success there. Again, as I said at the beginning of this chat, I think Latin America is going to be a huge win for them. I truly mean that. I absolutely mean that. They're going to push the development of that sport there, maybe at a financial cost to themselves that's considerable, but they're going to do it. In any event, sustaining that interest, not creating it, is a completely different ballgame. And I think that there is indisputable evidence they are having difficulty sustaining interest domestically. I don't think interest is going like that, but it's at a minimum flat line, at a minimum. And there's certainly evidence of decline. So I'm not sure where, yes, if they break into a new market and they have enthusiasm there, as they do so in the initial early stages, let's say the first 5 years or something like that, I can believe that the UFC will further develop mixed martial arts there, and that'll be fine. I can believe that. But domestically, if we're talking about creating casual fans by exposing to the brand, and all they need is regular exposure to turn them into pay-per-view subscribers, there is no evidence that is happening, that I can tell. If I'm wrong, by all means, let me know. It sounds good in theory. I don't know where this is happening. I do think they'll have success when they finally break into Germany. I do think they're going to have a lot of success in Singapore. As someone mentioned earlier in the chat, I think they're going to have a lot of success in South Korea. These are some of the places that are just a little bit more amenable to it, the right TV deals, the right kind of environment, the right kind of consumer base. So all those things are working out for it. But I don't see any evidence how oversaturation is helping the brand domestically at all. And we exist in a space where pay-per-views are still more than 50% of revenue. Now, when we get to a space where pay-per-views are, you know, 25% of business, we'll have a very different discussion about this, if and when we ever get there. But as it stands today, are pay-per-views going up at all because of regular exposure to the brand? If anything, they're on the decline. Guys, here's the reality about this global expansion that I just don't think anybody really takes seriously. Do I believe that the UFC is going to help grow mixed martial arts in Latin America to a pretty significant degree when it's all said and done? I don't think there's any way you can debate that. I mean, we'll see what happens, but like there's a lot of reason for optimism in Latin America. I don't mean just Mexico, all the way down, Guatemala, Honduras. I mean, these are lesser countries in terms of, you know, the resources they have to train athletes and the kind of athletes they have and so forth. But all the way down to Colombia or Panama and Colombia. Venezuela, we'll see. Venezuela might be a failed state in 10 years. But through Peru and Argentina, and we already know Brazil's a huge success, and Paraguay and Uruguay, it's going to be a big deal. These are rising economies for the most part. These are places that are, in some senses, I think democracy could be strengthening. I mean, these are stable states. These are consumer bases that are growing. These are places that have the ability to produce world-class athletes and train them up to a level, and you have a population that can attend shows in venues and pay money for them. All the ingredients that you need, and they have a certain amount of respect for the combative sports. Like, I think it's going to be a big win for them. But the truth about oversaturation is that the UFC is a premium product. How on earth do you grow a premium product at scale? I don't see how you do that, to be honest. I mean, you can do it sometimes cleverly. Everybody talks about this New Zealand show, man. I'm not saying they shouldn't put on the show, dude. They can put on the show, and New Zealand's happy, and Fight Pass customers are happy, and they make money. then what's the harm, right? I mean, I actually think of all the shows that UFC does on Fight Pass, this is the kind of, this is what a Fight Pass show should look like. You shouldn't be taking Alexander Gustafsson out of it to help sell the thing. Tahuna and Marquardt, these guys are coming off of back-to-back losses. Like, that's exactly what should be on Fight Pass. I have no problems with it in that respect. But here's the point. I mentioned it before. You can maybe grow the number of weight classes. I don't know how much UFC wants to do that. Certainly they're getting to the women's side of the game. There are only 10 fighters who are in the top 10 of each weight class, or 15. And yes, the quality of fighter has gotten better in the last 10 years. But the reality is, so have the fans' expectations about what they're willing to pay to see, both in terms of their time and their money. Opportunity cost and financial cost. How do you create more than 10 guys per weight class when there's always only going to be 10? There's still only 4 Grand Slams in tennis. Was it French Open, Wimbledon, U.S. Open, I think called Australian Open? I mean, we're messing up one of those, but you get the idea. There's only four. Right? The reality is, a premium product is just that. It's at a premium. It's selective. It's narrow. You know, when they get out of pay-per-view space, I believe that you can take a title fight and you can take it off of, when they no longer are relying on pay-per-view, they can put Jones Gustafsson in Sweden at a time that makes sense for them, and that's fine. They won't have to worry about that here. And so maybe that's the answer to the whole question. Maybe that's what they need, the freedom, the flexibility. But everyone says, well, you got this, you know, this New Zealand card, and everyone, this is a service for New Zealanders. It's like, dude, do we think the whole world is naive? Do we think that the whole world, all they want to see is their countrymen, and they don't care about quality? Hey, newsflash. Their palates are going to improve, and they're going to eventually want that premium product. But the UFC is basically doing it at this juncture, at least with some exception. I think that Fight Night show in London was pretty good. But the one in with Gustafsson and Manoa, but the one in New Zealand, it might be true that for now, that this customer base in Singapore and in New Zealand, they're willing to simply watch their countrymen. At some point, they're going to want to see the best. Just like if you become a fan of UFC through their Fight Pass shows, that's your first introduction to them, or you become a fan of UFC or MMA through Bellator or Strikeforce, you're going to get siphoned off to the top stuff. That's what every fan is going to head towards. And you can't make more than there already is without diluting the product. There's no way to grow a premium product at that kind of scale. It's just that. The only way to grow it is to lessen it. So that's my issue. Now, maybe when they get a pay-per-view, they can take these big fights around the globe and spread it out evenly, and that'll be fine. The MMA will be less popular here. It'll be more popular globally, and they'll have the freedom to move big fights around. But as it stands today, they have to get off pay-per-view or just diminish it as a function of their major revenue to get that to happen. As long as title fights and bigger stars have to be on pay-per-view, we're in a current predicament. So that's the issue about oversaturation that I have. It's like, people are like, well, this is a show in Germany for Germans. Dude, Germans are not going to just accept that forever. Like, they're going to want to see a premium product. Look at the fans in the UK, man. Like, they're dying to get cards filled with premium guys. And the O2 show filled out, they got Gustafsson on there. That's a premium product. It's a premium product, you know? So that's what I worry about. It's like, you're only going to have these top 10 guys, man. Only. And something has to give one way or the other. All right. Someone says, is Tahuna versus Marquardt the worst fight card ever? And a guy from Fight Metric says, according to MMA Junkies Mike Bond, Tahuna versus Marquardt is the first UFC main event ever featuring two fighters coming off back-to-back losses. That's who should be on Fight Pass. That's what Fight Pass should feature. I actually don't mind that at all. True or false, Nick Diaz will fight both Anderson and GSP when they return. False. If Bellator signs Kimbo and puts him on the September 5th card, Bellator will have a higher rating than the UFC card. I think that they will. And that sounds crazy, and that may blow your mind, and it may be sickening to accept. And I can, Kimbo Slice on the Bellator card, it's like, my God. But, dude, how else are they going to compete with UFC? For ratings, anyway. If Frankie Edgar would have won Season 5 with Tough, he would still be on a Tough contract. No. False. No UFC pay-per-view will reach 850,000 buys in 2014. That's true. Sad day for the UFC. I consider myself a hardcore fan with no life. Jesus, dude. Don't say that. But just imagining watching all 21 fights seems painful. Even if the UFC cherry-picked 10 fights from both cards, wouldn't you agree it would still be very weak? The lack of depth drives the demand for stars and lessens the UFC's brand power. I've made my opinions pretty clear on oversaturation. Who's going to win the World Cup? Unrelated MMA question, but I would be interested to hear your thoughts, especially since your partner is South American. I would assume you take interest in soccer. Probably the Dutch. Luke, did you watch last weekend's World Series of Fighting 10? I did not. I got it on DVR, though. I do plan to watch it. Quick true false. Mark Hunt beats Roy Nelson. True. But I don't know. I plead the fifth. Ben Henderson fights for the title again early in 2015. True. Pettis finishes Gilbert Melendez. False. Chael gets submitted in 2 minutes at Metamorphs. No, not two. Weidman versus Machida goes the distance. False. The UFC cuts back on the number of shows next year. They might cut back on certain types of shows. Alvarez fights Brooks now that they have a new boss. They might. That might change things, y'all. Rampage becomes Bellator champ, then retires. False. Vitor Belfort never fights for the title again. False. Vanderlei Silva retires after he's suspended by Nevada. That might be false, too. Someone's saying there's issues with the stream technology still. I don't know what's wrong with the stream technology. If you're watching it in Chrome, try to watch it in Firefox or something else. Okay. Best, worst part of Weidman's game plan. What do you think is Weidman's biggest strength and biggest weakness? It's almost the same thing. His willingness to compete on his opponent's terms. Right? On the one hand, it sort of like forces him to raise himself to the level. On the other hand, he can get into, I think, situations that wouldn't have to be as risky as ordinarily should be. How do you feel about his confidence and aggression in the cage? I feel like his aggression is what I would call appropriate, meaning it's there and ever-present, but never aggro, and his confidence is off the charts. Halle Gracie said there was no need to drug test the competitors of Metamorphs because in jiu-jitsu, the smaller fighter can beat the bigger fighter. Do you agree with Halle? They can't, but guys, let's just be honest. I love Metamorphs. Y'all know I love Metamorphs. I love jiu-jitsu. They can't test the fighters because they can't afford it. But I mean, you know, both, they can't afford to lose guys on the card, and they probably can't afford the testing. Let's just be real about it. And, you know, whatever. Like, these guys know what they're getting into, you know. I'm not saying it's good, but I'm not going to cry about it. I just have so many things to worry about. You know, this is about the last one. Besides, jiu-jitsu, steroids in jiu-jitsu are rampant anyway, so. Penn versus Edgar 3. Do you think this fight will at least be as competitive as their last? Or will Frankie be too much for BJ at this point? It might be slightly more competitive than we think. I think Penn, I don't know how Penn's going to look at featherweight, to be honest, but I don't think Edgar's looked as amazing at featherweight as I thought he would. But Penn at welterweight against McDonald was an absolute disaster. So, I don't know. I don't know what to expect. Hold on. All right, so some people are saying the stream is working fine. I don't know. The stream's not working for you. I don't know what to tell you. I'll get the MP3 up later. All right, Bellator 2.0. With Scott Coker replacing Remney, do you think Spike will take some of the things from Strikeforce like the old commenters, Paul Daly? I would love to see them sign Paul Daly. God, what a tragedy it is for him not to be competing somewhere. No, I don't think Jimmy and Sean Wheelock are going anywhere. That's my understanding. I think they're going to be right there. Now, they may have some augmented roles for other people, but Sean Wheelock and Jimmy Smith are your Bellator commentators. There's nothing official for UFC 174's buy rate yet. Metamorphs 4, I completely understand Sonnen's value to the show, but isn't Galvão Sonnen a huge mismatch? Yes. I think it'll definitely help promote the show, but will eventually somewhat hurt Metamorphs' credibility. that's the sort of nature of the business that they're in, and it's something, you know, Gloria has to do as well. Like, on the one hand, you want some names that have crossed over to MMA, your Miguel Torres's. Now, he was out of the four-man tournament, but Mirko Krokov, right, things like that. But you want to make sure that you still put on, you know, their premium product. And I think Gloria does a pretty good job with that. I think most of you would agree. And I think Minamoris will, too. Guys like Barnett's a legit black belt, you know. And, you know, he's a cash wrestling guy. But I've seen him compete in the gi. He's a black belt in the gi. By the way, I think that match is going to suck. I think that match is going to suck. And the reason why is because I think Josh Barnett's awesome. And I think Dean Lister is also awesome. It's nothing against those guys. I don't like Dean Lister's style of play in a no-limit sub-only format. I feel like he just sort of doesn't really go for the kill. I feel like he kind of lets guys dictate the thing and then just gets out of all the submissions because his defense is astronomically good. I think that's what's going to happen. I think Barnett might even dominate it, like, positionally and from a attempt standpoint, because I think he's just way more aggressive. But I don't know. I don't have high hopes for it. I hope I'm wrong. That's how I thought that Babalu match was. It's just Dean Lister being like, I can get out of anything, which he can, you know, but I'd like to see him push it a little bit more. Is it a big risk for Woodley to come back so soon after his last loss? Do you see him turning in a statement performance and getting the W over Kim? I don't know how, I've been trying to think about how that fight's going to go. I don't have a strong opinion about it going one way or the other yet, so I'll put a rain check on that. What I will say, let me correct this one too. What I will say is, I actually think it was the right call. He didn't take a ton of damage. He got like a week off. All these guys would be back in the gym training anyway, unless they have like severe mental problems or something, or financial, which he doesn't. And I think Kim is a beatable fighter. A tough fight to beat, but a beatable fighter. And the reality is, if he didn't take this fight, he ran the risk of finding himself on the prelims. Of finding himself, now he's fighting on Fight Pass, which is, you know, got its own issues, but at least he's in a role against a top-level competitor. I think that's how he sees it. He sees himself up against somebody who is a respected competitor, a high-ranked competitor, and at least on that card in a prominent role. Hey, I mean, it's only under Bisping and Kung Lee. So it's certainly not without risk, but I think it's appropriate level of risk. I think he made the right call. He may lose, I don't know. But that losing on that kind of stage, I'm not going to say it's better than winning, because winning is always better, but I think he worried that he might have been pushed so far back down the pack, he may have really lost the ability to... I think he just wanted to stay relevant. Like, he goes, okay, I slipped up against McDonald, but if I can beat Kim, I'm right back there. That may not be the case if he waited and took some fight down the road against a lesser competitor. He may have more fights he has to do to get built back up. So, not without risk, but not without tremendous reward either. If Silva still has a titanium rod in his leg when he returns to the UFC, is that a competitive advantage? I don't know. But I should ask a doctor, shouldn't I? TJ, Faber, and Cruz. Which fight would you like to see the most? Faber versus Cruz 3, or TJ versus Uriah, or how about the prospect of TJ versus Cruz? TJ versus Cruz, because TJ and Uriah might cancel each other out, and I do want to see Faber. I mean, not that I wouldn't want to see it. I want to see all three, but TJ versus Cruz is the one that, see how Cruz looks when he comes back. But if he looks good, you put him in there with TJ, that's the fight I want to see. TJ versus Uriah, they could cancel each other out a little bit, although everyone says that TJ now just big brothers him. And then Faber-Cruz 3. I want to see that too, but not as much because Cruz, I mean, I just think he's better than Faber at this point. Yes, and get well soon, my friend. This is a weird question. I once spoke about this on the MMA Hour, and I believe this is more prominent now than ever. After watching a BBC Horizon program on color psychology, I was drawn to a study which included the following. Researchers Hill and Barton showed that wearing red sports attire has a positive impact on one's outcome in a combat sport. I went back and looked through all the controversial decisions in MMA. I was surprised to find 9 of 10 were worn by fighters in red gloves. In the last 2 weeks alone, we have seen Schaub and Arlovsky and Pearson versus Sanchez fights, both terrible decisions given to the fighter. Well, they weren't red gloves. They were red taping. All the gloves are black. I need to read the study, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of this was true. But I need to read the study to tell you if it's crazy or not. Bellator contracts. A couple of weeks ago on the MMA Hour, Mike Hogan said King Mo has a lifetime contract with Bellator because of the tournament structure. With Bellator now out of the tournament business, would they have to restructure everyone's contract? I do think there'll be some fairly substantive restructuring. I don't know that everyone's going to get new contracts because they may not enforce the tournament aspects of those contracts. But here's what I believe. I think part of the reason why Scott Coker was brought in is any number of reasons about how he creates a mixed martial arts product, one that, in his words, moves the needle. Certainly that's maybe the most important consideration. But if that's number one, then number 1A or 1B or number 2, however you want to position it, is definitely the fact that Coker has strong relationships with managers, fighters, and various sundry other people in the mixed martial arts community, because I think that they believe he does right by them. He is an honest broker, that he believes in fighter welfare. He believes in creating an environment that fighters wouldn't want to be in to the extent possible. When people were talking about Gilbert Melendez being stuck in Strikeforce, they weren't talking about him not getting paid. Now, they weren't saying that he couldn't make more necessarily as a pay-per-view commodity in UFC, but given the resources Strikeforce had, they were taking care of Gilbert Melendez, you know. It was just that he didn't have the opponents he could face. That was sort of the big issue there. I do think that going forward, they're going to try to create an environment that gets rid of the negativity and the baggage that the last regime had. That when you sign a Bellator contract, you're not going to be stuck for life. You know, we expect you to fulfill the demands and the obligations therein, but hopefully there'll be no more articles written on Bloody Elbow by Mr. Nash. It's a good article about just how suffocating and, you know, borderline illegal maybe some of those old Bellator contracts were. Barnett versus Lister, Metamorphs 4. I think it's a good, listen guys, it's the right match to make. I'm just a little worried it's going to be a stalemate. That's all I'm saying. Talked about Vitor already. I don't care about Vitor's situation at all. I'm not saying I hope he gets licensed, but like of all the things to care about. Big Nog versus Frank Mir. I read that Big Nog wants one more shot at Mir. Would you like to see that at all? No. Alexander Emelianenko facing criminal charges for sexual assault and rape of a 27-year-old woman. I think old Alexander has some issues, huh? Do I eat grilled cheese with ketchup? I don't know if it's a Canadian thing, but my friends who are from or around D.C. seem to think it's a disgusting idea. Well, it sounds pretty gross. Not as gross as eating A1 on your steak, but it's pretty bad. I've already talked about Glory and their premium product. Let's see. Eminem, the rapper, openly admitted his new battle rap league, Total Slaughter, Jesus, is following the UFC's formula for gaining national attention and to broaden the appeal beyond the hardcore fans of battling. They have an Ultimate Fighter type show with all the battlers living in one house and we're putting the battles on pay-per-view. Thought it was interesting that they openly admit to using the UFC's formula. Well, historically, UFC's formula is pretty good. But Jesus, do I not care about battle rapping. It's an interesting question. No regulation for Metamorphs? I plan on ordering the next Metamorphs. It will be the first grappling tournament I've ever really watched. It's not a tournament. There's no tournament bracket. It's just a series of super fights. I'm a big Chael Sonnen fan, but his inclusion on the next Metamorph show had me wondering if Metamorph is regulated at all by an athletic commission. It is not. No drug tests? No. Is there prize money on the line? I mean, they contractually pay a certain amount. I don't understand how an athletic commission can bar an athlete from competing in one sport, and yet he's free to compete in another. Someone else says here in the comments, I have competed in numerous BJJ grappling tournaments, which include everything from the IBJJF Worlds to Nagas of the Worlds, even smaller tournaments where there was literally no belt distinction. We were only separated by weight class. In all these cases, there was never an athletic commission representative present. I'm sure those who grew up in the traditional martial arts have similar experiences when they competed in karate tournaments, which have light sparring. I know when hosting an event, there are insurance considerations to be had, which is true, but I don't think a privately run grappling contest would fall under the jurisdiction of the athletic commission. You see guys in submission contests every day across the world when you walk into a jiu-jitsu gym, and the only paperwork necessary is that you sign a waiver that you won't sue the gym if you get hurt while training. That is also true. I'm not sure why it doesn't fall under the jurisdiction, if for no other reason than perhaps budgetary restrictions. Halleck Gracie had mentioned that it could be that what they're doing is an exhibition, and so therefore they are free from significant forms of regulation, or really any forms of regulation. I think the only issue is that it's the striking martial arts that they get super regulated, you know. For example, like the wrestling tournament, they had USA versus Iran in LA, and I think at a Beat the Streets event. You know, that's regulated by FILA, it's sort of a loose sense, but in USA Wrestling, which is, of course, a member of FILA, but it's not regulated by the California State Athletic Commission. All the weigh-ins and drug tests that are done under the auspices of, I think, USADA, which is working in conjunction with USA Wrestling. So, I'm not sure. Private number. Yeah, I'm definitely not answering that. Let's see. The media has Stockholm Syndrome with Dana White. Luke, why does the media's love affair with Dana White continue, despite the fact that often he insults and belittles them? I don't know if we have a love affair with him, but our job is not to love or hate him. Our job is to report on the sport, and many of the most important things about the sport come from him. You know, if he insults us, you just got to take it. If he praises you, you know, you can take that too, but... you got a job to do, right? Like, it doesn't matter if he calls you a clown or he gives you a high five or he tells you a good job. You're supposed to do it one way. You know, I'm not going to say, look, you know, maybe his act is worn thin for some people, but I think a lot of people, especially in the mainstream media, they really like Dana White. Like, they think that his candor is refreshing, you know? There's still a lot of appeal to it. So, but in terms of, like, the MMA indigenous media, it's definitely... people still like it a lot. Oh, I want to talk about this. Most egregious offense. Is it one? Luis Suarez biting someone for the third time in a match. That's high up there. Two, Jason High pushing a referee, potentially concussed. I think Jason High got raked over the coals, man. Three, claiming you need TRT because your balls don't work. That's a bad one. Or four, USA giving up a goal in penalty time. Do you understand? I want to cry. 30 seconds left from advancing. Anyway, Bradley. Michael Bradley just not showing up at all. Let's see. Let's see. I would say number two. Well, the most egregious offense is number one, but the most egregious offense is how Jason Hyde was treated. Can we stop pretending this is some scandal, what he did? Like, this is such, you know, like your Red Fox oh, I'm, what was it, Bertha Herr, I'm coming, you know what I mean, you're having a heart attack. Can we stop pretending that he flew a plane into a tower? I mean, what a non-event. What a ridiculous thing that has happened to this poor guy. I mean, I can't even fathom how, dude, if you were a mixed martial arts referee, and I don't mean to belittle them, I mean to make an analogy. You are a referee, and that is your cage, and no one has a right to put their hands on you. That's absolutely true. And if someone does, you got to figure something out about it, okay? But you're also a bit of a rodeo clown. And what I mean is you're dealing with a deranged bull. There was an article that came out on SureDog written by a doctor maybe a couple of years ago, and he was talking about the chemical balance in someone's brain after both they win and lose, meaning the endorphin rush from winning and maybe some of the other states they're experiencing if they're having any sort of like brain injury or at least brain impact. And what it basically said was your brain is so hopped up on chemicals